From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be. Across the nation, around the world, I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Open lines next hour, but we've got lots to catch up on right now, and let me get right into it. In Wichita, Kansas, Wichita police have arrested a person of interest in the BTK serial killer case, turning him over to the FBI for questioning. Wichita Mayor Carlos Mayans told reporters there will be a news conference at 11 o'clock a.m. Eastern Time on Saturday. He would not confirm or comment any further, but police sources say they're confident that the person of interest was the man they were looking for. The man was arrested in suburban Park City, just north of Wichita, and his home was subsequently searched. Police made the arrest near where one of the BTK killer's recent packages was left. Authorities considered him a person of interest in the 1980s, but did not resume investigating him until recently. He is married, 59 years old. The person of interest, who works in the Code Enforcement Department for Park City, graduated from Wichita State University in 1979 with a degree in administrative justice. Why is that important? Detectives believe the BTK killer has ties to Wichita State because some of the communications from him were copied on machines at the university. The BTK killer, the initials of the killer's self-coined nickname, stand for Bind, Torture, Kill, has been linked to 8 unsolved killings committed between 1974 and 1986. Major Ed Dames, remote viewer, and his team have been looking into this case. Ed is with us briefly to fill us in. Ed, can you tell us a little bit about what your team's been doing?
Well, George, we've been hammering away for the last 7 weeks at a description of the BTK. Actually, Vicki Wegerle, we chose one of the victims where any reasonable police officer would agree that Vicki Wegerle was a victim of the so-called BTK killer. We chose her to have chain of custody, and we were looking for the residence of her killer. So 5 men, 2 women, hammering away the last 7 weeks, and we were scheduled to, we are still scheduled to fly into Wichita en masse in March. If this individual indeed is the killer, we'll still go into town to get feedback from my team members, because I have 2 new team members who need to see the residence that they sketched, and we'll turn our attention to another murder case in Wichita.
And apparently the home was very important in this investigation, Ed, so I'm sure the work that you and your team has been doing over the past several years in this case has probably been very important.
George, it's only been 7 weeks.
7 weeks total?
We have not worked
okay.
This case, but we've just hammered away. In fact, when you called me this evening, I was working on the nearest significant feature to make sure that we had the right part of town.
Very good.
So we still don't have confirmation until tomorrow.
No, that is true. Yeah. That is absolutely true. And then the trial, the investigation, the evidence, and everything else. But Ed, thank you for that quick update.
My pleasure.
Ed Dames, Major Ed Dames, remote viewer. Pope John Paul II munched on cookies, jotted messages to an aide about his condition as he recovered from surgery to ease another breathing crisis. The Vatican took pains to emphasize the positive. The 84-year-old Pope was breathing on his own, showed no signs of pneumonia, ate breakfast that included coffee with milk, yogurt, and 10 small cookies. But other descriptions were impossible to ignore. John Paul fitted with a tube to ease his breathing and following doctor's orders to avoid speaking at least for several days. A judge gave Terry Schiavo's husband permission to remove the brain-damaged woman's feeding tube in 3 weeks, handing him a victory in his effort to carry out what he says were his wife's wishes not to be kept alive artificially. The ruling by the judge, George Greer, will allow the husband, Michael Schiavo, to order the tube removed at 1 p.m. on March 18th. In the meantime, the woman's parents, who want her kept alive, are expected to ask another court to block the order from taking effect. An Italian scientist, a name that we've talked about on Coast to Coast, working on the Mars Express probe, says gases detected in the planet's atmosphere may indicate life exists on the red planet. Right now, Vittorio Formisano told the Dutch space conference that methane and formaldehyde could signify biological activity. But the cautious professor from the Institute of Interplanetary Space Physics in Rome said only soil analysis on that planet could prove it. In a moment, our own investigator, Linda Moulton Howe, as we talk about some things that are going on planet Mars. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Linda Moulton Howe is an Emmy Award-winning writer, television producer, investigative reporter, and author. She goes straight to any assignment that we send to her, but she also does her own investigating as well. And this time, Linda is doing a little probing on Mars, as we could say. Hey, Linda, next hour, by the way, too, I want to get your reaction to the ABC special on UFOs.
Okay.
And by the way, in terms of ratings, very interesting. It was a two-hour special. The first hour, the ABC UFO special was rated number two of all the stations, all the networks that had programming, which was pretty darn dramatic. And then the second hour, it had some slippage. It dropped down to number three, ending up with an average of about an 11 share. But they were very happy with that first hour showing. But we'll get to that next hour. You've
okay.
got a full report. Go ahead.
Well, thanks, George. This has been quite a week between what's been happening in Holland at the ESA conference and my own investigations here in New Mexico with the only geologist working on the Spirit rover on Mars. And he told me that there was a discovery by the Spirit rover on Mars which thrilled NASA scientists last summer in 2004, but it didn't make much news with the public. You know, Spirit and that other rover Opportunity, they've been looking for hard geological evidence of water on Mars. And Spirit's discovery that we're going to hear about tonight is what one geologist calls, quote, courtroom evidence for water, unquote. Has Martian surface water burst from the warmer interior when the crust has cracked open from some tectonic movement? Has that water contained life? If organisms did live in Martian water, could they still be frozen in surface ice, or even be living today underground and in caves on Mars? Could living organisms explain methane, formaldehyde, and water vapor reported this week in the Martian atmosphere? Well, I talked with scientists studying those questions at the European Space Agency's first Mars Express Orbiter Conference in Holland, and with this geologist in New Mexico who is working on the Spirit rover mission, and all of the scientists are intrigued by this growing pattern of discoveries from the ground-based rovers and the orbiting spacecraft that add up to a lot of liquid water on Mars in the past, surface pack ice now, and atmospheric gases that might be linked to present subterranean living organisms. So tonight on Coast, I would like to begin at the New Mexico Museum of Natural History and Science, where geologist Larry Crumpler, Ph.D., receives data from the Spirit rover on Mars and designs maps. And then in the second half hour, I have fascinating new European research to report about a frozen sea on Mars, an update on atmospheric gases, and an American scientist's investigations of sulfur and mineral-eating organisms that might have extraterrestrial cousins on Mars eating away right now in caves and subterranean places on that red planet. It was only 14 months ago, on January 3rd of 2004, that NASA's Mars exploration rover Spirit bounced and rolled for those several minutes in the Gusev crater near the Martian equator, and then sent a signal back to Earth that the rover was okay and ready to work. Well, Spirit had landed south of a smaller crater that's inside the huge Gusev crater, and scientists decided to drive Spirit over to take a look inside of what came to be known as Bonneville Crater. It took 90 Martian days, called sols, to get from the landing site just up to the rim of that crater to travel around and to look at those volcanic rocks there. A Martian sol is 24 hours and 37 minutes. Our day on Earth is just a little shorter than 24 hours. So 90 sols on Mars is equivalent to about 92 Earth days, or 3 months. And that's why last March, there was a lot of media attention to Spirit's drive around the rim of Bonneville Crater. But for Dr. Crumpler, who is research creator for volcanology and space science at the New Mexico Museum of Natural History and Science in Albuquerque, he was frustrated that the only ground that Spirit was rolling over was lava laid down in the recent geologic past. In Spirit's search for evidence of water on Mars, Dr. Crumpler and other scientists wanted to move on further to distant hills rising out of the Gusev Crater. They could see it. So last April, Spirit took off across Gusev's lava plain into highlands called Columbia Hills, and the rover has been climbing ever since. Today, on February 25th, Spirit has completed its 406th sol on Mars and has shown NASA geologists what they originally set out to find: Martian rocks exposed to a lot of water. One discovered in mid-January in the Columbia Hills was named the Peace Rock and has such a high concentration of magnesium sulfate deep inside that it provoked Dr. Crumpler to say, quote, "It must have soaked in water," unquote. And at my website, www.earthfiles.com, you can see an amazing new photograph of this Peace Rock after it was drilled into by the Spirit Rover's RAT tool, and it exposed this gray-white, sulfur-rich interior rock. It's an amazing photograph. All this happened after Bonneville Crater, when the decision was made to explore higher ground in the hills, not knowing how long Spirit could keep going. Here now is Dr. Crumpler.
Because then we started doing the really dramatic stuff, the really exciting stuff, the real Lewis and Clarking on Mars type stuff. We basically realized at the end of the primary mission, we're out in the middle of these plains that weren't going to provide us the evidence for the ancient history of Mars that we were looking for, because these were clearly younger lava flows. And we could see these ancient rocks sticking up called the Columbia Hills, way to the southeast, and those would potentially be much older rocks that would be from the ages that we think were a time period when there was a lot of water on Mars, or some water at least. And so we wanted to go there, but the problem was those were 2.5 kilometers away, about a mile away from where we are, and we're on the rim of Bonneville. And so anyway, we at the end of the night, Saul said, okay, well, we're just going to go there, do or die. We're going to do a death march across the plains, get to the Columbia Hills, and find out what's there. And so we basically turned the rover on a heading of about 130 degrees south, east from north, and started driving. We finally made it to the Columbia Hills. About Sol 150, we were approaching them. And it was quite spectacular because as we approached it, the terrain became much rougher. It was like surf, you know, lapping onto a new continent. And we started going through these undulations, and they were causing a lot of rover difficulties. We were having trouble actually, you know, we were actually over tilting. And so we would time out, basically, and we would have to, you know, reset and go again the next day. And as we approached it, within the last few, last 50 meters or so, you know, it was like literally like approaching a new world, and we were wading ashore from the surf. And we finally made it on Sol 156. We rolled off, literally rolled right across the contact from the plains onto the Columbia Hills, and then basically the whole mission changed. Because at that point, we were in rocks that were totally different, a totally different age, much older, much more evidence for alteration. And also the terrain changed. Suddenly we weren't in plains anymore. Now we're in mountains. And literally as of this moment, we're climbing up the side of this mountain. And we're seeing things that you know, just haven't been seen before. We're in a new geology.
Columbia Hills tends to support at least the idea that these rocks were underwater for a long time.
Yeah, they could have been underwater, or they could have been underground, you know, where there was kind of a groundwater system, even though the surface was dry. And so the water could have been in any number of forms and present for any number of time periods. But the point is that they are like, I don't know, I guess if you had to compare it with stuff on the Earth, the rock to to get a rock that altered, you'd have to like soak it in kind of acidic water for, I don't know, hundreds or maybe thousands of years. And the rocks in the Columbia Hills are just, they've seen a lot of water. They've been soaked, they've been altered, there's all sorts of evidence that, you know, it was a different Mars when those rocks were laid down. So that, it's hard to find a boundary like that here on the Earth that you can walk across.
That would explain why Steve Squires would say that peace, from his point of view, was the most important rock that had been investigated with the Mossbauer up to the middle of January of 2005.
Yeah, that's right. And we had seen sulfates, magnesium sulfates, on various occasions before, including hematite and things like that, that all indicated water. But this is, you know, it's so pervasive in the rock, and the rock is so soft and rotten looking that it really requires, you know, that there was a lot of this fluid present to do this to such a large mass of rock. So, I mean, this is scientific evidence for lots of water. I mean, we pretty well suspected that from what we've seen so far in the Columbia Hills, but, you know, this is, you know, evidence that you can take to the courtroom, as it were, and, you know, prove that, you know, Mars was probably wet.
So Mars was wetter when these rocks were deposited, and it was just to me, I mean, that's the greatest accomplishment of this mission, was that we walked across that boundary, and so we saw what the Middle Ages of Mars were like out there on the plains, and now we know what the early ages, or at least the latest early ages of Mars were like. And they're totally different. So it says that early Mars was really wet, and suddenly that climate just changed very early in the history, and things have been a lot drier since.
About how far back in time do you think that change occurred?
Well, that's the big question, too, is we don't have any age dates on any of the materials on Mars. We haven't brought any samples back that we can run through a lab and get a date on. So we have to kind of estimate what we think ages are. Probably, you know, the ages we're talking about for the Columbia Hills as opposed to the plains, you know, like a billion years differences in age, maybe. So, you know, 3.5 billion as opposed to 3 or 2.5 billion.
The hypothesis has been that if there was a lot of water, and maybe it has gone underground deep in Mars, below the permafrost, and that there may, in fact, be organisms that are releasing methane and formaldehyde.
Yeah, you know, that's something that just makes a lot of sense, but, you know, you just don't have any data to, you know, to say whether making sense is, you know, correct sense or not. But it makes a lot of sense because we know that there's been a lot of water. The water's gone someplace. Water soaks into the ground. There's a lot of place for the water to go, and there's, you know, a lot of warmth in the inside Mars where the water could stay unfrozen and, you know, circulate. And so it's just not radically inconceivable that you could develop a biota that, you know, was microorganisms that, you know, lived in the substrate, you know, in deep underground. And it's just it's entirely plausible. We don't have any evidence for that, and I guess the methane business is one little spike in the efforts to suggest that may be the case. And what we need is many data points that really compel us to believe that, because that's such a radical idea, a concept that, you know, there is life and that it's underground, but we need more data, as we always say. And more data means more missions.
And the next planned NASA rover mission to Mars is set to launch in 2009. It's called the Mars Science Laboratory Project. But before then, another orbiter instrument that can actually look underground for ice and water is the MARIS Deep Ground Penetrating Radar. It's been down for a year. It was supposed to have come online last spring. They said they had engineering problems, and they were afraid to deploy it, but it was announced at this ESA conference this week that the MARIS radar will finally be turned on in May, in just a couple of months from now. And, George, when that information gets combined and overlaid with what the atmospheric data is, what the pack ice data is in the Elysium Planitia, we'll start having almost a three-dimensional look at Mars, where water, ice, and maybe underground organisms might be.
Back with more with Linda Moulton Howe in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.
The official website of Coast to Coast AM is www.coasttocoastam.com. Log on now. Coast AM with George Norrie.
Still interested in that After Dark CD? Well, you've got some time for this one. AfterDarkCD.com, that's the website to order the 2.5 hours of bumper music, ghost stories, and calls to the program. www.AfterDarkCD.com. There's also a toll-free number for the CD. That's 1-800-598-2331. 1-800-598-2331. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, along this hour with Linda Moulton Howe. Linda, it's fascinating that today, finally, Vittorio Formosano, a person you talked to some time ago, the Italian physicist speaking in Rome, talking about the possibility now of small biological life on Mars.
Well, you know, it was a year ago, back in March of 2004. And I talked with him several times, and I reported that methane and other gases, and he told me off the record at that time that it was formaldehyde, and this week he went on the record with formaldehyde, were in the Martian atmosphere. And the data was coming in to him because he's the principal investigator of what is called the Planetary Fourier Spectrometer, or PFS for short. He built it. It's mounted on the European Space Agency's Mars Express Orbiter. It was designed specifically to detect methane and other gaseous molecules. He's been based at the Institute of Physics and Interplanetary Science in Rome, Italy, for a long time. And on Thursday this week, he showed for the first time spectra not only of methane, but traces of formaldehyde and water vapor in the Martian atmosphere. And further, Dr. Formosano said that the strongest concentration of methane was over the eastern Elysium Planitia near the equator, the same region that Dr. John Murray at the Open University in England says that he has found a huge frozen sea. Now, Dr. Formosano's methane measurements and distribution are supported by other NASA research data. But so far, the formaldehyde is controversial because the spectra are weak. If formaldehyde is confirmed from the orbiting PSF by further data and other scientists, the implication is that a constant supply source is necessary, since formaldehyde breaks down every 7 to 10 hours in and under the strong ultraviolet radiation from the sun on Mars. Now, one of the highlights of the ESA conference was Dr. John Murray's presentation about finding this huge frozen sea near the equator in the eastern Elysium Planitia region on Mars. And I talked with him last night by phone at the Netherlands conference. He and his colleagues are taking seriously the possibility of underground life on Mars. And first, I asked him where he thinks the frozen seawater came from that now covers an area 900 kilometers by 800 kilometers and averages 45 meters deep.
Okay, this would be fascinating.
The nearer you get to the center of Mars, you more this is affected by geothermal heating. So there's a region sort of 6 kilometers to 10 kilometers down, something like that, where you actually get liquid water, where you get a liquid, where you certainly get large reserves of liquid water. And so if you can tectonically crack the crust, as it were, down to that level, then of course the water is going to shoot up to the surface under pressure, because the Mars atmosphere is a very low pressure. So it would be like opening a bottle of champagne, which is why this water comes out at this very high pressure and why you get these very, very, very high discharge rates, as I say, much greater than anything we get on the Earth.
Now, what are the implications in finding this huge ice pack near the equator in the Elysium Planitia for possibly finding life in that pack ice?
Well, I think that's one of the most interesting possibilities from this whole thing. Because this erupted so recently, the date we get from crater counting is 5 million years. Now that does sound like a long time, but in geological terms, it's virtually yesterday. So, as I say, these events have been known to occur throughout geological history. So if it's still occurring now, that means that we have pockets of warm water, and by warm I mean above freezing point, beneath the surface of Mars for thousands of millions of years. Now, under those conditions, if it's possible for life to develop, and I think most biologists now believe that life is possible developed, then it's highly likely that it would have developed over that period of time. This mission, the results that we've got in the past year, have completely changed my ideas about the planet Mars. Before the mission, I was all for looking for life, but fundamentally I thought of it as a dry and dusty place, and that if we did find life, it would be in the form of fossils from the dim and distant past. I now think that it's a very real possibility that we do have life surviving at the present moment. And interestingly enough, in the discussion we had today, at the end of today's session, among the scientists in the audience, it was put to the vote, how many of you believe that life could have formed ever on Mars? And I think 75% of the people put up their hands, and that's opposed to probably something like 5% 10 years ago. Then people were asked, do you believe that life could exist on Mars at the present time? And more than 50% of the people put up their hands. So I think, as I say, this mission has changed, really, our opinions about whether life could exist on Mars at the moment.
And this was an audience largely of scientists.
It was, yes. I mean, the audience today, in fact, was that there were a lot of biologists in the audience today. Earlier in the week, it was more astronomers and geologists and so forth, but the sessions yesterday and today were specifically about life on Mars, so it was a very informed audience.
After you heard Dr. Formisano talk today about his formaldehyde evidence, if it holds up and you combine that with your pack ice hypothesis, that strengthens the possibility that there's life underground right now.
Well, I hope it does, yes. I mean, certainly deep in the oceans of the Earth, particularly around warm areas such as volcanic vents, black smokers, very deep beneath the sea. There are whole communities of microorganisms which are in fact common ancestors to many forms of life on Earth. So if it could happen on the Earth in such an inhospitable environment, why couldn't it have happened beneath the surface of Mars?
And what kind of creatures, George, might live on Mars? Well, scientists think our own Earth might give some clues. This week, scientist Richard Hoover at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama, reported that he has discovered bacteria in Alaskan permafrost that had been frozen for at least 30,000 years. The scientists bored a tunnel down through the permafrost and found a kind of golden brown layer that was about 18 inches thick, and it contained brown-colored bacteria. Dr. Hoover says that when he looked at a sample of the bacteria-filled ice under a microscope, this is a quote, "These bacteria that had just thawed out of the ice were swimming around. The instant the ice melted, they started swimming. They were alive, but they had been frozen for over 30,000 years," unquote. Could there be bacteria in the Martian pack ice? Dr. Murray in England would like to see a rover mission drill holes into that frozen sea at Elysium Planitia to look for organisms there. And this week, I also talked with Dr. Penelope Boston. She's director of what's now called Cave and Karst Study Program at the New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology. And she also is associate professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences in the Earth and Environmental Sciences Department at New Mexico Tech in Socorro, New Mexico. And she was explaining that she has been focusing on caves in Mexico, which is the nation of Mexico, and in the state of New Mexico, looking at organisms that are, believe it or not, there are manganese and iron eaters, there are sulfur eaters, there are all kinds of eaters. And as she said to me, quote, "These are the master chemists of our planet. The rest of us big organisms really inherit this kind of the spectrum material that these guys produce." And she goes on to explain that she now has and is developing a huge catalog from methane-producing organisms, the manganese and iron eaters, and the sulfur eaters, which, by the way, the sulfur eaters release aldehyde gases. They are not sure how or why, but this may be relevant to Mars. And she said that what they have found is that these creatures all over the planet, there really is no cave, there's no underground place that they go that they don't find some organism that is chewing its way through the rock, whatever the rock is. Mm-hmm. And the very interesting data point here that they might be able to use on Mars, and she's very interested in the sulfur and the magnesium sulfate and all of these high sulfur-rich rocks that they're finding, because she has sulfur eaters down in caves in Mexico. And when they study the metabolizing sulfur of these, they find that they do give off aldehydes, of which formaldehyde would be a form of aldehyde. They don't fully understand the metabolism, but they have also found that these organisms that chew through rock all over our planet, deep and near the surface and in caves and Carlsbad and all over the place, they end up leaving crystals. They emit crystals as the residue of chewing through whatever the rock is of these various organisms. And she thinks that they're going to be able to have like a whole suite of what they call biosignatures from what all these different organisms excrete, and that they could take this into, say, to compare on Mars and see if they can match up anything. And another very interesting point, the DNA of these creatures on our Earth that are eating through rocks is not really even recognizable in terms of what they normally would think of in terms of DNA creatures. It's another area of study. In other words, they are so weird. These creatures on our own planet are so weird. She said that actually, she said, you know, Linda, we could end up finding things that are really so foreign, quote-unquote, on Mars, but she said the process will be the same. They will be creatures that will eat through the rock. They will leave these signatures in crystals, and we may be able to find them that way.
I am pretty sure that based on everything everyone's saying, Linda, that there's some kind of life on Mars. The big question is did it come from Mars to us, or did it go from us to Mars?
That is a very interesting question.
Hey, so in good report, by the way.
Thank you.
Give me your take. Did you see the ABC special on UFOs last night?
Yes, I did.
I was a little disappointed.
I was more than a little disappointed. I will start with my biggest complaint, and that is to dismiss the hard, both testimonial evidence, some hard physical evidence of what happened in Roswell, the documents that describe three vehicles crashing with a lot of detail, and having it dismissed as a Project Mogul balloon by one person without really any counterbalance, I thought was actually irresponsible. I didn't consider that to be journalism.
Did they try to consult you or call you to get your input into this thing?
On this particular show, no. There were many people I know that I would have thought would have been naturals for some of the content that they covered who were never contacted. And another thing is that I thought it was so undeserved for Stanton Friedman to be referred to as a promoter.
Yes.
When he is a master of science. He did his education and got a master's of science degree in the area of working in nuclear energy industries. Stanton is a solid investigator. I respect him enormously, and the way he was dismissed, like Roswell, was totally undeserved. And essentially, George, to me, it was like watching what I have seen in so many programs in the so-called popular media, and that is build straw horses so that you could knock them down, and then when you knock them down, you remain, quote-unquote, politically acceptable to your media peers, but you've done, a tremendous disservice to the public, which I think deserves much deeper investigation and truth, not sarcasm and not dismissal.
And, you know, they didn't do anything with the Philip Corso case. They didn't do anything about Billy Meyer and some of his pictures, whether you believe them or not. It was almost like it was very elementary, and, you know, as I called it last night, ufology 101.
Well, it wasn't that because it was not honest and it was not accurate. I do think one of the pluses was the second to the last segment with the physicist from New York, Kaku.
Yes, I thought he was our guest last night, by the way.
Yes, it's wonderful. His book's Hyperspace, and I think the other one is
Parallel Worlds.
Parallel Worlds, right. They are wonderful books. I would recommend them to everyone. And at least he is trying to say that we don't have all the answers on how travel might be done in this vast universe, and that if wormholes are theoretically possible in quantum physics, that if there is something out there that is, I think he said, a million years in advance, not 100, but a million, they might be able to bend space and time, which is totally consistent with Einsteinian physics and quantum physics and string theory as it's evolving. And if you have the ability to bend space and time, that's the Alcubierre space warp, where you really aren't moving on a Euclidean line, you are bending space and you end up in another place because you can change space. But all of that is theoretically on paper to the physicists. It's all possible. And if it's possible to human physicists today, after only, a few centuries in terms of modern physics, it's not very long, then something else out there that's very, very advanced, and this is a very big and old universe, and we're in a younger galaxy, the possibility that somebody else knows how to move around this universe. And, George, this is something that I think is never discussed quite enough. We keep assuming that we can look for signatures in hydrogen or sound, because we think of those references on the Earth. If we're dealing with advanced intelligences who have gone beyond, let's say that they're not using radio waves. I don't know that that's possible.
No, I think you're right. I think they may have evolved beyond that.
So we may, as Bruce Maccabee and Hal Putoff and Jim Deardorff and Bernie Haich in that very, very important paper that they submitted and was published in the Journal for British Interplanetary Research or Science just a couple of months ago. I think it is so important because what they were trying to say is with the advancements in inflation theory in the universe and the development of string theory and all of these issues of wormhole travel, you really, in a way, are doing a disservice as a physicist and a scientist if you do not go back and look at the possibility that all of these reports by people around the world for decades might have something to do with extraordinary contact and interaction with the Earth that is not in normal human frame of reference. And if you even go that far and you begin at least saying to science, you know, there are reasons to look at this phenomenon because science itself is evolving faster and faster, making a lot of things, interdimensional penetrations are part of the new physics. Why can't this phenomenon be now looked at in the context of all of this new evolving physics? And I think that an entire two-hour special on network television on this area, boy, would that be refreshing and wonderful.
I'll tell you what I want to do too, Linda. Why don't you work with Lisa, our producer, and come up with two or three other panelists. I want to do another roundtable discussion, but specifically on the UFO phenomenon, and we'll get you to fly up here to L.A., and we'll do it, but sometime in April, okay?
Oh, I would love to do that. Thank you.
Okay, you start working on it.
That
next assignment. We'll be back in a moment. Open lines for the next 3 hours right here on Coast to Coast AM.
Find out more about tonight's guest. Log on to coasttocoastam.com.